Welcome to our guests, or visitors. Hope you enjoy your time here, and we'll enjoy you. Seems like it's been a busy week for me. I think just kind of characteristic these days. I'm sure yours was busy too. Well, you know, we've come to know quite a lot of information and knowledge and instructions from the great God of the universe and what He's given to us to understand and to know and to use for conduct of our lives. He's taught us a lot about the universe and about the earth, and we've come to understand those sorts of things and regard what God has done in creating them. He and the Word are the ones who raised the entire existence that we know of, and they're teaching mankind to live within that and utilize His laws and purpose in doing so. Taught us a lot about what the future holds, what the blessings are going to be for us. They've taught us the history of mankind. Most of the world wonders where mankind came from and what mankind is here for. But our God has taught us about this. We've learned about the terrible intrusion of Satan that has interfered with tremendous impact on the lives of every one of us. As astonishing and as thrilling and as intriguing as these massive events are, which are just an overview, a thumbnail sketch in a way, there's something in addition that make these seem like they're kind of sterile. As massive as they are, as interesting as they are, they're just facts. They're just technical in a way to characterize them that way. God deals with us in an emotional realm, in a loving relationship, which is far different from this technical aspect of how and when and where. But He brings us into a relationship that involves why and who. And so I think that's much more meaningful. We're not just some little trained animal, a pet that's learned to do some challenging tricks. He wants us to become full members of His family, fully engaged in the life He's given us here that's looking towards the eternity that will be our lives. And that's astonishing. It's awesome. It's also real. And I think it's why it's not so that He can really see in how we cope, but rather that He can teach us to be prepared for that amazing future and to be made the most of both for Him and for us. And that we can love it and learn how to live it properly as He does. And so we can be able to utilize what we know and learn and grow with in here, in our life here, and enjoy it forever. So we have a God, a nice God, a loving God, a wonderful God who provides these kinds of instruction and training for us. The Bible's chock full of stories and events that our ancestors have all gone through. Recorded for us. That's very thoughtful too. Recorded so we can look back and see what they actually experienced. And they certainly provide the life experience or the living experience in a way in their day and age. And those experiences are preserved so that we can be instructed by them and learn from them and learn how to handle the same kinds of things on a day-to-day basis. So I think these are important aspects to think about as we go into this particular subject. Now, I want to address one major aspect of our approach towards that today, and that of being sure that our heart is right with God so that we can endure and overcome the challenges that certainly come in each of our lives and that we can know how to cope with them and deal with those difficult things, the tough things, and they will come. It's not if, but they will. So I want to give this message in referring often to some of our ancestors and what things they experienced in the tough times that we went through. So let's go first to 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 11. Now all these things happened to them as examples, and they were written for our admonition on whom the ends of the ages have come. You said that many people's experiences are preserved for our benefit, and this certainly says it, you know, direct. They're for our benefit. They happen to them so that we could have examples that we can learn from. Examples for our admonition. Now, admonition is kind of a mild rebuke or a warning. They're there so that we can come to understand the things they did right, the things they did wrong, what that meant to them, and what a similar situation would mean to us as we come across something that's similar. So we can learn with far less hardship than that they had to suffer with. So what's being talked about here? When we see the experience that Israel had in going through their time in the wilderness for 40 years, it came about for a reason. Israel spent that time, and the things they experienced were in part written for our example. Now, if they hadn't done that, we wouldn't have that example, and we'd be kind of wondering, it'd be a different story, essentially, that Israel would have gone directly to the promised land, and we wouldn't have these sorts of examples. But the things they experienced are useful for us. Now, most of them, those that are over 20 at the time the 40-year period came to an end, they weren't permitted to enter the promised land because of their murmuring and their tempting God by rejecting him or challenging him or asking for things or ways of doing things that were not appropriate, and being idolaters as well. So there are plenty of other things in the Bible that give us good instruction in the same way, and I'll address some of those. And I'll do so in three groupings. I titled these good leaders, bad leaders, and mixed bag leaders. Terminology of the day. Well, we'll go to Job. Now, I don't want to make sure that those are the exclusive categorization of anything, obviously. They're just general representations of a particular class. And every person, every being, every leader has had good and bad things in their lives, as we all have. But I wanted to turn to Job, and I'm putting this under the heading of good leaders. We won't read an awful lot in Job, but let's go to Job 1 and verse 13. There was a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. I simply bring this out to show that there were multiple brothers and sisters in Job's family. Verses leading up to this show he had flocks and herds and camels and servants. He was pretty well off. He was wealthy. He had a large family. And then this says he also had sons and daughters, and they were having a good time together, getting along together, enjoying wine together, and other things undoubtedly. It shows at least some were older, had their own houses, because they were in the older brother's house. So God had allowed a family situation to develop over a lot of years. This isn't like he's just fresh, created to be a being that was especially good, but this was just the normal life result. And God allowed Satan to strip Job of all of these things, because Satan and God said, God, Job, he has other reasons to follow you and accept you and so forth. And so God allowed him to take action against Job to prove to God something. Now, in Job 2 and verse 9. I guess I didn't say that. Yes, Satan destroyed it all. He took all of his wealth, his house, his family, his flocks, his herds, his servants. They didn't take his wife, apparently, because it says here that his wife said to him, "Do you still hold to your integrity? Curse God and die." So he didn't get a whole lot of support. And this is just showing that she was probably awed by the degree of difficulties that Job was made to suffer and probably blamed God for it. And so in the process of stripping his possessions and afflicting him with all these difficulties and loathsome sores, of course, we read of him sitting on a pile of ashes and he's scraping his sores. It must have been a terrible time for him. And it was Satan's contention that Job's heart was not really good. It was just because God had protected him and blessed him that he if he was taken away from all these things, then he would curse God. That was Satan's contention. I'm sorry, I think that was over in 2:9 that I read that. Chapter 1 and verse 9, it says, "So Satan answered the Lord and said, 'Does Job fear God for nothing?'" He's in essence saying, he knows where his bread is buttered. He's doing things that please God so that his wealth and capabilities and life continue on the way it is. Well, Job endured all the loss with great aplomb, and he didn't blame God. Now, you can read chapter after chapter of his friends coming to him and talking about what's the problem. Why have you done this, Job? Whatever it is, we'll find out what it is. You've done something wrong, or God wouldn't let this happen to you. And that went on for a long, long time, trying to find out what the problem was, and they felt like Job was hiding it from him. And he's trying to, of course, Job, find a cause too. He'd like to understand it, obviously. He just didn't see the great, enormous difference between God and man. He knew he was living well. God knew he was living well. But Job didn't really see the depth of difference between mankind and God. Now, it wasn't until in chapter 40, and I'm not going to read that at all, but when Job had tried to defend himself, and God was saying, "Where were you when this happened, when that happened, when the stars were made, etc.?" And then in 40, he began to tell him things about creation that Job had never considered, and that got his attention. So Job responded, and let's go there to 42, Job 42, in verse 3. "You asked, 'Who is this who hides counsel without knowledge?' Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderful for me which I did not know. Listen, please, and let me speak. You said, 'I will question you,' and you answer me. I have heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I abhor myself and repent in dust and ashes." So when Job finally understood the massive difference that God is from any humanity, he understood, and it was very repentant in his attitude for what he had thought and what he had said. And he was a very great example for all of us, because from the very beginning we see he was really blessed in his youth and with his family and his possessions and his herds and flocks and so forth. He was looked upon and respected, to the extent that Satan even wanted to use him as an example that he could break down. Job lived a good life, a proper life, a respectful life towards God. He prepared his heart for serving God, apparently from the earliest age, and had been well blessed with all these things. And then it was all taken away. He did not accuse God. He's looking for why he did something wrong. Tremendous attitude. I don't think any of us would stand up as well as Job did to these kind of conditions if we were subject to them. I certainly don't feel I would. But he did not falter at all. And God blessed him as a result when all this was over, blessed him with more than he had in the beginning, and included 7 sons and 3 daughters. So he still had a wife. I don't know if it was the same one that told him to curse God, but obviously he had a wife. And God gave him 140 more years to live. So I'm sure that Job's heart continued to be right with God, probably even more so than in the beginning. And we've seen that his heart was right all his life, as far as we can see. A fantastic example of somebody that really lives properly, the good example of a leader. Now let's look at Daniel in the same category. Another good example for us is Daniel. So let's go to Daniel chapter 1. Daniel 1, and we'll read 1 to 4. "In the 3rd year and reign of Jehoiakim, king of Judah, Nebuchadnezzar, king of Babylon, came to Jerusalem and besieged it. And the Lord gave Jehoiakim, king of Judah, into his hand with some of the articles of the house of God, which he carried into the land of Shinar to the house of his god, and he brought the articles into the treasury house of his god. And the king instructed Aspenaz, the master of his eunuchs, to bring some of the children of Israel and some of the king's descendants and some of the nobles, young men in whom there was no blemish, but good-looking, gifted in all wisdom, possessing knowledge, and quick to understand, who had ability to serve in the king's palace and who might teach the language and literature of the Chaldeans. So this kind of gives the setup for the four Jewish lads, Daniel and his three friends, being taken back to Babylon after they had been conquered. And they're taken back there to be trained in the knowledge and the traditions of Babylon. Daniel 1 and verse 8, Daniel purposed in his heart that he would not defile himself with the portion of the king's delicacies, nor with the wine which he drank. Therefore he requested of the chief of the eunuchs that he might not defile himself. So this is a little glimpse of Daniel's character and attitude. He was going to be taken and kept in the king's palaces with all his training and treated royally with everything they considered delicacies in that nation and in that time while he's being trained. But, you know, it might have been unclean. Daniel was trained already. He had his heart set to follow God's ways. So he didn't want to eat these delicacies, didn't want to drink all that wine and whatever else was probably very rich food. And so he purposed in his heart so that he would not do that, would not submit to that. In 17, also, let's read there. For as these four young men, God gave them knowledge and skill in all literature and wisdom, and Daniel had understanding and visions and dreams. And at the end of the days, when the king had said that they should be brought in, the chief of the eunuchs brought them in before Nebuchadnezzar, and then the king interviewed them. And among them all, none was found like Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah. And therefore they served before the king. And in verse 20, in all matters of wisdom and understanding about which the king examined them, he found them 10 times better than all the magicians and astrologers who were in his realm. So Daniel and the other three young lads really distinguished themselves, partly because they ate properly and observed God's laws, partly because they were endowed with some great intelligence and understanding and ability to learn and skills, probably partly because God knew that he wanted to use Daniel for a greater purpose as well, although it doesn't tell us that. Now, as we know, Daniel was able to interpret Nebuchadnezzar's dream and the image about the gold, etc. Let's read over in chapter 6 and verse 3. Verse 3, and this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and satraps because an excellent spirit was in him, and the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault. What a fabulous record of Daniel's performance. They couldn't find any charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault found in him. Then these men said, we shall not find any charge against this Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. So through all his training and preparation, Daniel stayed in touch with God, stayed devoted to God. And this bespeaks of his character. So they set a trap for Daniel, and they got a law passed that nobody could worship anything except the king for 30 days. In verse 10, let's read that. And now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home, and in his upper room with his windows open towards Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since early days. So again, proves Daniel had character. God, he had his mindset on God. He's devoted to God. And regardless of whether there was a threat of death or not here, he maintained that belief and commitment and followed through on it. It could mean his death, but he chose to honor God. The net result was that he was cast in the lion's den. God stopped their mouths. He wasn't harmed at all. And those that brought all this charge against him were all destroyed in the trap that they had prepared for Daniel. And I think that's always quite an interesting thing when God turns something totally around, and the one that makes the accusation gets the thing that he was planning. Anyway, there's certainly more in the book. Suffice it to say that Daniel prepared his heart to serve God above all else, and he did so throughout his life, and God took care of him. And I think that also is a great lesson for how we should live our lives, try to follow what Daniel did. So here's two great examples of good leaders and how they responded to God, obeyed God, followed God, loved God. Well, let's look at bad leaders just a bit. Don't want to spend too much time on bad leaders, but let's just consider this example of an all bad leader, Rehoboam. Just a little of the story is too much to recount, and it's difficult to keep in mind anyway, so many things happening, it seems like. But a little bit does help perspective. In 2 Chronicles 9:30, it's recounted that Solomon reigned over Israel for 40 years, and he died and was buried. So then his son, Rehoboam, reigns in his place. And so let's go to 2 Chronicles in chapter 10. This is where we are. Okay, in verse 10 and verse 1, Rehoboam went to Shechem, for all Israel had gone to Shechem to make him king. And happened when Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, heard it, that Jeroboam returned from Egypt. In verse 3 then, "Then they sent for him and called him, and Jeroboam and all Israel came and spoke to Rehoboam." And they're speaking to him to find out how is he going to conduct his rule now that he's taking over the kingship from Solomon. And so what is explained is that he's going to seek advice from the counselors that Solomon used, and then he's also going to seek advice from his buddies, the young lads that he grew up with. And unfortunately, instead of listening to the wisdom that was given by the counselors to Solomon, he chose the younger folks' advice, and it was harsh. So there is a general rebellion and a lot of intervening things that we're not going into here and so forth. And Rehoboam ended up with only the cities of Judah. And all the rest of Israel essentially said, "I'm out of here," and went to their hill towns and so forth and didn't support Rehoboam at all. Now, in 2 Chronicles 11:5, Rehoboam dwelt in Jerusalem and built cities for defense in Judah, for defense. So he's looking at being, safe in his own confines with whatever support he has. In verse 11, it shows he fortified the strongholds, put captains in them, and stores of food and oil and wine and so forth. He was intending war with Israel. And as you read these verses, God prevented that from happening. God didn't want the brothers fighting with one another, the brothers of Israel and Judah. So God prevented that. In verse 15 and 16, he appointed for him, now this is Rehoboam, he appointed for himself priests of the high places for the demons and for the calf idols which he had made. And after the Levites left, those from all the tribes of Israel, such as set their heart to seek the Lord God of Israel, came to Jerusalem to sacrifice to the Lord God of their fathers, and so forth. So here he is, newly king, newly minted, lost the support of most of his country, and now he's setting up for himself for the high places and the demons and calf idols, those that he wants to be recognized and followed in a religious sense in his kingdom. Now, In 12:1 it says, "It came to pass when Rehoboam had established the kingdom and had strengthened himself that he forsook the law of the Lord and all Israel with him." He forsook the law of God. It's not very wise for a king. A king whose father and grandfather were so noteworthy in honoring God and were blessed by it as being the richest kingdoms that ever occurred. And he did this right off the bat in his reign. Forsook God. Set up idols. Set up things for demons. Now verse 13 of 2 Chronicles 12, verse 13. "So King Rehoboam strengthened himself in Jerusalem and reigned. And now Rehoboam was 41 years old when he became king, and he reigned 17 years in Jerusalem, the city which the Lord had chosen out of all the tribes of Israel to put his name there." His mother's name was Naamah, and so forth. So here he is at the end of this reign now. He's 41 when he became king, and he reigned 17 years. But now let's read the epitaph about how his reign is viewed. In verse 14, "And he did evil because he did not prepare his heart to seek the Lord." So his total reign is characterized as evil, wrong, bad, improper. And, of course, he paid the price for it. Point is, this is because he did not prepare his heart to seek God. Total opposite of what we read in the other two examples. So that should again be a great lesson for us that, while we're not going to be kings in this life, but the principles certainly apply in whatever our little domain might be. We might say our family is our kingdom or whatever you have influence over. It certainly applies. We must not forsake God's law. By contrast, we need to prepare our hearts to serve God, to seek God, to seek His ways and keep His ways and make that a constant commitment and way of life for how we live. So that means we need to humble ourselves regularly. We need to pray. We need to talk to God. We need to seek His instruction, His guidance every day. And the trouble is that when we have it easy, and I'm afraid we have it fairly easy these days, well, then we're subject to stumbling in some fashion. When we don't have trials, it seems that they help center us. They keep us on the right track, because we turn to God much more readily when we have some difficulties and challenges. So the point is, don't let down on our praying and continue our reliance on God. Now let's look at this other category, mixed bag leaders. I have only one really great example for this category, and that's King Asa. Asa was really, really good at the beginning. Well, we'll turn to 2 Chronicles 14. In verse 1, it tells us, "Abijah rested with his fathers, and they buried him in the city of David. And then Asa, his son, reigned in his place. In his days, the land was quiet for 10 years. So he took over. He had a nice beginning, apparently, and it lasted, coasted along for quite a few years here, 10 years. Land was quiet, no problems, peace, prosperity, religious resurgence, and so forth. In verse 2, Asa did what was good and right in the eyes of the Lord his God. Again, the point of what we're talking about today. He followed God. He believed God. He followed his ways. He sought his ways. And did what was right to the point where it's actually recorded here. Not just that God kind of found it okay, but recorded. He did what was right in God's eyes. He removed, you read through the rest, we're not going to, but you read in here and you'll find that he removed altars, he removed high places, he broke down sacred pillars, he cut down wooden images, and he commanded the whole country, commanded Judah to seek God and observe his laws and commandments. Wow, could it be any better for a kingdom? And he looked into God's law and he changed things under his control. And that's the kind of thing we can do. Whatever our little kingdom is, look into God's laws. If we find something that doesn't match, change it. He did that. And that's what we've done, really, in our life, because I think we've all been, called, brought to repentance and baptism. Well, repentance means we looked at God's law and what He's telling us, and you say, hey, I haven't been doing this right, I'm going to change. And so we can make those changes. We have made those changes. And Asa taught Judah. We each within the church teach in our conversations with one another and Bible studies and what have you, sermons, sermonettes. We teach within the church that way. We teach within our families that way. I'm sure God is pleased. He was pleased with Asa. I think he's pleased with our conduct within this context, within our families, within our church. And why is it? It's because it's a result of our preparing our hearts just as King Asa did, to seek God, to follow God, to obey God, to follow his ways throughout our lives. So if you read on a little bit, you'll see the first 10 years he built up the country, he fortified the cities, he fixed up the walls and the gates. He had an army of 300,000 people to protect the country. And you'll read a section about Ethiopia coming against them with an army of 1,300,000. Far bigger than Asa's army. And he defeated them. God allowed that. God caused that. And it was because Asa was ready. He had prepared his heart to serve God. Whatever the circumstances, he knew God would take care of him. And he did. So he prepared his heart and was victorious. And that same thing applies to us. We have our hearts right. We have something coming against us. If we continue to have faith and trust in God, he'll take care of it. We can't see how, but he does. We heard those stories in our church midst many times in the past. Well, as we continue on, King Asa still had things to clean up. And go over to chapter 15 and verse 1 and 2. Now the Spirit of God came upon Azariah, the son of Oded. And he went out to meet Asa and said to him, hear me, Asa, if all Judah and Benjamin, the Lord is with you while you are with him. If you seek him, he will be found by you. But if you forsake him, he will forsake you. So here's an affirmation about Asa to that point. He's told that the Lord is with him as long as you are with the Lord. And vice versa. In verse 8, and when Asa heard these words and the prophecy of Obed, the prophet, he took courage and removed the abominable idols from all the land of Judah and Benjamin and from the cities which he had taken in the mountains of Ephraim. And he restored the altar of the Lord that was before the vestibule of the Lord. So he's still at it, still cleaning up the country. Restored the altar of God. Now let's read in 9 and 10. And he gathered all Judah and Benjamin and those who sojourned with them from Ephraim, Manasseh, and Simeon. And they came over to him in great numbers from Israel, even they when they saw that the Lord his God was with him. So they gathered together at Jerusalem in the third month in the 15th year of the reign of Asa. So they saw that the Lord was with him. A lot of people joined him. And it affirms here that after 15 years, he was still good with God. And he did other things in verse 19. There was no more war until the 35th year of the reign of Asa. Just jumps over here from 15 to 35. 20 years. Nothing's told us about what was going on here. But the story changes in 2 Chronicles 16, 1 to 3. In the 36th year of the reign of Asa, Baasha, king of Israel, came up against Judah and built Ramon, and he is that he might let none go out or come in to Asa, king of Judah. And then Asa brought silver and gold from the treasuries of the house of the Lord and of the king's house and sent to Ben-Hadad, king of Syria, who dwelt in Damascus, saying, let there be a treaty between you and me, as there was between my father and your father. Here I have sent you silver and gold. Come, break your treaty with Baasha, king of Israel, so that he will withdraw from me. So the story's changed a lot now. All of a sudden, he's not depending on God. He's depending on his own wealth, and he's actually using church funds, gold from the temple as well as his own, to make a treaty, to buy them off. And he stopped relying on God and he trusted in his own wealth. He trusted in silver and gold instead of God. In verse 7, and at that time, Hanani, the seer, came to Asa, king of Judah, and said to him, because you have relied on the king of Syria and have not relied on the Lord your God, therefore the army of the king of Syria has escaped from your hand. So whatever his plans were, didn't work out because he didn't trust in God. He trusted in his own power. And Asa was angry about it, and he put this poor guy that told him the story. This is where you kill the messenger. You know, he didn't kill him, but he put him in jail. In verse 9, for the eyes of the Lord run to and fro throughout the whole earth to show himself strong on behalf of those whose heart is loyal to him. In this you have done foolishly, therefore from now on you shall have wars. And then Asa was angry with the seer and put him in prison, for he was enraged at him because of this, and Asa oppressed some people at that time. So a total change in his attitude and character and how he handles things. Kind of summarizes the story of him, but let's just read a couple of more verses of it. Note that the acts of Asa, first and last, are indeed written in the book of the kings, Judah and Israel. And in the 39th year of his reign, Asa became diseased in his feet, and his malady was very severe. Yet in his disease, he did not seek the Lord, but sought physicians. And I certainly want to, you know, make note that we, Church of God, believe and trust in God. We anoint, we are healed, we trust Him and have faith in Him. And we still use physicians. But it's first, put your first trust in God. And if we can get a little mechanical help from the knowledge available these days, okay. But at that time, it was one or the other. You trusted in God or not, and He did not. But He sought physicians. And that's so far different from what he began. He hardened his heart. And so Asa rested with his fathers in verse 13 and died in the 41st year of his reign. So he had quite a history. He had 35 years of just great devotion to God, commitment to God, following God. And he relied on God. And here, just 6 years before his death, where he'd always prepared his heart, now he didn't. Now he switched. Now he trusted in his wealth and his friends and trying to make treaties with them. And so it's a terrible thing. And even this sickness, we don't know exactly what it is. May have been an infection of a very severe nature and killed him. So he died as a bad guy instead of the 35 years worth of being a good guy. It's a warning to us. It could happen to us. Diane and I have been in the church way over 40 years. I think we've always relied on God. What would happen if we changed our attitude? Would we be in the kingdom if we rejected Him? If we don't continue to prepare our heart to serve God? You apply that sort of thinking to you. You don't know what sort of troubles are going to come upon one another and how we'll react to them. We kind of have to make our mind up now where we are, where we stand. And I think that's what he didn't do. The lesson is, it's not how we start, it's how we finish that counts so much. I mean, you can spend all this time doing good things and then at the end do terrible things and negate it all, lose it all. The only way is to choose God every day, and we should prepare our hearts and know where we are, know where we stand, know where our faith is and our trust before we have those trials come. So that when they come, we already know how we're going to respond. And that's what Daniel did. That's what Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego did. When they were going to get thrown in the fiery furnace, they didn't know that ahead of time. They just knew they would trust and believe and have faith in and dedication to God. So that when the trial came, they didn't have to decide anything. They didn't say, well, should we go with the king and bow down and worship that idol even though we don't really believe? Or should we trust in God? And of course, we all know that story, that God preserved them, saved them out of that terrible condition. So when we go to God, He will help. The key is seek God first. Let's turn over to Revelation. Just a couple more here. Revelation 2 and verse 4. Now, you remember these. I'm not going to read much of this at all, but this is a section in Revelation 2 and 3 to the seven churches and all the instruction and so forth that God gave to them. And I just wanted to read chapter 2 and verse 4. And this is to Ephesus. Nevertheless, I have this against you, that you have left your first love. Now, that isn't that exactly what Asa had done? Left his first love. 35 years of that love. But it's summed up here in a sentence that we need to know better. We need to keep our first love. Revel in our first love, if you will. Peter had a problem in this way too. I'll just make mention of it quickly and not read anything. But Peter said he would rather die than deny Jesus Christ when Jesus was beginning the trials that led to his death. He said he'd die rather than deny Jesus. But then, and that was in Matthew 24:32, and in Matthew 26:74, he denied Christ. Now, he didn't think he would. He thought he was totally committed. But he did. So a challenge comes on you, and you really have to be prepared for it. He couldn't have been too prepared for it, or he wouldn't have done that. He didn't have God's Holy Spirit yet. We do. And we know what so many of these lessons have been given to us in the Bible to prepare us so that we can devote ourselves to God, so we can prepare our heart to serve God. Just a thought here in Revelation, also in 13 and verse 15. Now, this is talking about the beast power. He was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their foreheads, and that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark of the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, we read those things, and we kind of try to wonder what they are. Could it be an implant under your skin that has your ID number, you know, whatever, all those sorts of things. But the important aspect of it is that we not bow down to and respond to a threat of death, which is what this is indicating, that that beast power has enough power to kill us. Or at least wreak horrendous havoc on our lives. So what if we have a family and they're living with us and they depend on us? Whether it's mine, whether it's yours, anybody in the church, how do we look at it? How do we prepare for it? We can't know the particulars and the details, but you know, when your children and your grandchildren are starving and all you have to do is say, okay, put that little thing under my skin and you can feed them, what do? We need to decide ahead of time. We need to prepare our heart of how we're going to follow God or whether we're weak and going to give in to Satan and the beast. Those are the kind of things that we can gain from looking at the Bible. There's some real examples. Real people suffered real things just like this is portrayed to be. And we have to know ahead of time where I'm committed. And then we'll be okay. That's preparation of the heart. So to conclude, the Bible's filled with information about things we do see and understand and have come to exist. The universe, the earth, life, mankind, laws, guidance in how we're expected to live as a literal part of God's kingdom. The thing is, none of this matters a bit unless we actually are successful in doing that. And that entails, above all, making our heart right with God and maybe better said, allowing and cooperating with God, yearning for and grasping for and making our heart, letting Him make our heart right with Him. Because it's probably more than we can do on our own. We need God to help us do that and to yield to Him. And we can and should and really must do this continually, day in and day out, searching and studying God's instruction manual. So we understand it, we gain these lessons that He's giving to us, and we are applying these lessons that we come to understand of living righteously to the best of our abilities. So we must prepare our heart to serve God every day.